Testing, John, is that all right? Testing, testing, testing. Okay. Good evening. Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the 14th annual Marcoux de Porres Social Justice Lecture. I'm Dr. Roger Bergman, Director of the Justice and Peace Studies Program in the Creighton College of Arts and Sciences, sponsors of this lecture series. I would ask you to silence your cell phones and other devices. And I'd like to acknowledge and welcome Father Schlegel, the President of the University, who's in the back of the auditorium. Father Schlegel, thank you for being with us this evening. You might take a moment, if you haven't already, to look at the blue half sheets on your chairs. Those describe on one side the previous lectures in the series, which I hope you will agree is a pretty distinguished bunch of people. And the other side, especially there for the benefit of students, to encourage you to look into the Justice and Peace Studies program. And you'll notice that the dates, the speakers have been set already for 2008 and also 2009. And for next year, the first time, we will have not one but two lecturers. We will have a dialogue between two nationally prominent Catholic authors and commentators. George Weigel is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the author of a major biography on Pope John Paul II. And the Reverend Drew Christensen of the Society of Jesus is the current editor of America Magazine, the Jesuit magazine, and formerly an international policy advisor to the United States Catholic bishops. Mr. Weigel and Father Christensen will engage in a dialogue on just war ethics and their application to our current war. Needless to say, they have been on opposite sides of that question. Should be a very interesting evening. That's on October 2nd, 2008, here again in this ballroom. And please also notice that I'm really getting ahead of the curve. The lecture for 2009 has been set. November 16th of that year will mark the 20th anniversary of the martyrdoms of the six Jesuits at the University of Central America in El Salvador, and you'll be hearing much more about that this evening. The Reverend Kevin Burke of the Society of Jesus, who is currently Dean of the Jesuit School of Theology at Berkeley, will speak on the legacies of Pedro Arrupe, Superior General of the Society from 1965 to 1983, sometimes described as the second founder of the Jesuits, and Ignacio Echeverria, who you will also meet in the slideshow this evening, who was the rector or president of the University of Central America from 1979 until his assassination in 1989. Father Burke has written books on both of these major figures. Specific date is still be determined, but we'll be letting you know. We have 2 years on that. Before introducing tonight's lecture, I'd like to bring Dr. Robert Kennedy, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, to the podium to offer you his own welcome and a brief glimpse at the namesakes of this lecture series. Dean Kennedy.
Thank you, Roger. Good evening. Welcome to the 2007 Marcoux de Porres Social Justice Lecture. This lecture series is named in honor of Father John Marcoux of the Society of Jesus in the Omaha de Porres Club. He founded on November 3, 1947, in what is now the Schleich Room on the fourth floor of the administration building. Father Marcoux, a member of the mathematics faculty, mentored that club through the 1950s and into the 1960s. The club was made up mainly of students from Creighton and other area colleges. Named after St. Martin de Porres, the patron of social justice, the objective of the club was the realization of racial justice here in Omaha. The Catholic Church celebrates the feast of Martin de Porres on November 3rd. What made the Omaha Deploys Club so remarkable was its use of nonviolent but militant tactics several years before similar boycotts, sit-ins, and marches garnered headlines in the South, especially under the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Before Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement achieved national and even international prominence, Father Marcoux and the Deploys Club stirred consciences and challenged racist attitudes and segregationist practices right here in Omaha. We honor Father Marcoux and the Deploys Club with this annual lecture series. On behalf of the Creighton College of Arts and Sciences and Creighton University, welcome to this year's Marcoux Deploys Social Justice Lecture.
Thank you, Dean Kennedy. Seldom does a Jesuit receive an assignment directly from the Superior General of the Order. 17 years ago, tonight's speaker received a request from Father Koldenbach to leave Santa Clara University, where he was academic vice president, to take the same position at the Jesuit University, the UCA as it's known, in San Salvador. He replaced Father Ignacio Martin Barro, one of the Jesuits assassinated in 1989. Think for a moment about how you would respond to such a request in such circumstances. As a result of that change, he spent the 1990s working in both El Salvador and Guatemala, during which time he wrote the definitive history of the UCA, Jesuit Education and Social Change in El Salvador, published in 1996. And he said this afternoon that he thought this might be his most lasting legacy. From 2000 until just a few months ago, the Reverend Charles J. Byrne of the Society of Jesus served as president of Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York, one of Creighton's 27 sister institutions in the United States. Earlier this year, Father Koldenbach again asked him to take on a special assignment, this time to serve as a consultant to the Jesuits of Africa as they develop their dream for the first Jesuit university on that continent. What a testimony to the Jesuit vow of availability for mission and to the Society's centuries-old commitment to pioneering the finest educational opportunities where they are needed the most. Father Byrne is Vice Chair of the Commission of Independent Colleges and Universities and serves on the boards of the Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities, the Association of Catholic Colleges and Universities, and various civic organizations. He is also president of the foundation of the Rafael Landivar University in Guatemala, where he served as academic vice president and professor of education after serving in the same capacities in El Salvador. A native of New Jersey, Father Byrne holds a PhD in education from the University of Chicago, bachelor's and master's degrees from Fordham University in New York City, where he's currently on sabbatical, and master's and licentiate degrees from Woodstock College in Maryland. He was ordained a Jesuit priest in 1969. As Father Koldenbach's faith in him attests, I doubt there is anyone anywhere better prepared to address this evening's topic, Jesuit education and social change in Central America, United States, and Africa. It is an honor to have him with us at Creighton for this lecture and for conversation with administrators, faculty, and students. Please welcome the Reverend Charles J. Byrne of the Society of Jesus.
Where does it get hooked? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Roger. Thank you, Dean Kennedy, and thank you, Father Schlegel, for coming, and all the other folks that are here. It really is a great privilege to be here for the whole community. The topic tonight is really one that's very, very important for all of us, on higher education as an expression of our faith justice commitment. The lecture honors these wonderful people that we just heard about, and it really is terrific to be part of that tradition. Now, Creighton has a long history of concern for the poor and places the promotion of justice as a prominent part of its university mission. Such concerns permeate the academic programs, as even a brief review of the webpage shows so clearly. And the university offers many opportunities for service to the wider community. Now, at the risk of singling out anyone, let me mention the work here of Father Ray Bucco, an old friend and fellow alumnus from both St. Peter's Prep in Jersey City and the University of Chicago, whose work with Native Americans has captured the imagination and gained the admiration of so many. I thought I would start with some pictures of very real people, rather than statistics. I'm sure you'll be very disappointed at that. These are people that I first met in El Salvador 26 years ago, in July of 1981, before most of the audience was born. And then what I'll do is I want to explore very briefly a few key documents that serve as a scaffolding for an analysis of issues that are involve these people and so many people like them all over the world, such as Guatemala, and now in this new exciting project in Africa. The most important part of our event this evening, however, is the give and take of a dialogue at the end of the presentation, so I will try not to ramble on forever. What I did only recently, and I only did it once, and I probably should have done it a second or third time practicing, is I put these slides together that go back to 81, and they show some of the martyrs, the guys who were murdered in El Salvador. It shows you some of the people who were the victims of oppression, and it brings it alive in a way. So you'll have to kind of listen to me for a little while on the dialogue that's there. But if you look at these pictures, you'll see them as the context in which we're going to talk about what the implications of this are. So we have light, camera, and this part. Whoa, I forgot I'm attached here. All right. That was close.
Vern, I took a number of these slides when I was the headmaster of Regis High School in New York. It gives you a flavor of what was going on in El Salvador during the 80s and during the 90s. In these slides, you'll see several of the Jesuits who were murdered in 1989, on November 16th. And then in the early 1990, I was asked by Father General to replace one of them, Father Ignacio Martín Barón, as the academic vice president. You'll see many statistics about how many people were killed and the kind of poverty that people live in, but it's important rather than think about statistics to think about little kids like the ones on the screen. El Salvador depends a great deal on agriculture, which of course is a serious problem when you have agricultural products from the United States and from the European common market that are heavily subsidized and then dumped on these countries at a time when they depend so much on agriculture. And this is a very, very serious question with regard to their being able to move forward economically. So many people live like this. I took these pictures inside the Jeep being driven by Father Segundo Montes, later one of the martyrs, because I didn't want to embarrass these people with their poverty. These pictures of well-to-do homes in Escalon, I took these inside so I wouldn't get shot by their guards. But people could live in conditions like this and others could walk right by and not really notice them and then move into their own houses that look more like this. Now, this is a typical example of what is at the root of some of the economic problems of El Salvador. In the late 19th century, the ejidos, which were commonly held lands, were taken over by the government and sold to some well-to-do families for very, very small amounts of money. They put ads in the paper and said, now, if you've been living here for many, many centuries and decades, you can come and make a claim. But the only problem is that many of the people were illiterate, didn't read newspapers, they couldn't afford them, and so they didn't even know that their land was really up for grabs, and so many of the poor lost it. So much of the wealth of El Salvador is based upon land that cattle in trucks and She came by this working.
Back to the beginning.
Celebrating the Mass. And this woman, in the homily, Father Cortina
had. We've skipped ahead. Go back and start it over.
Through so many terrible things. God would understand if you tried to get some revenge on
Could you
people.
Put it back
and
to the beginning?
This picture, this woman was saying, oh, no padre, no puede ser. And he said, well, why not? He said, well, because we're Christians. So that was her explanation for why she really felt that vengeance would not be appropriate, even despite the fact that kids were under these conditions. Again, you can see the pain in the face of these women. Here they were receiving communion.
Please leave it
the
alone. At the beginning. Right there.
That look more like this. Now, this is a typical example of what is at the root of some of the economic problems of El Salvador. In the late 19th century, the ejidos, which were commonly held lands, were taken over by the government and sold to some well-to-do families for very, very small amounts of money. They put ads in the paper and said, now, if you've been living here for many, many centuries and decades, you can come and make a claim. But the only problem is that many of the people were illiterate, didn't read newspapers, they couldn't afford them. And so they didn't even know that their land was really up for grabs, and so many of the poor lost it. So much of the wealth of El Salvador is based upon land that was gotten in the late 19th century under very questionable circumstances. This is a typical way that people were traveling in the early 80s, as if they were cattle in trucks. And a lot of times the soldiers would stop them. Here's an example on the left of a soldier getting ready to stop one of these big trucks with the people there. And this is where a lot of people would disappear. Disappear became a transitive verb. You disappear to people. And the women would be put on one side, the men on the other. And then if the soldiers didn't think they had proper documentation, then that was the end of them. This is La Boca del Diablo. It's a place that was a favorite place for dumping the bodies of human rights victims, and you'd always see carrion in the air flying around. Again, this is a scene in a refugee camp in the lower church in San Roque. This woman and child, it's almost like a pietà, and you can just see the pain on the faces of these people. Now, these pictures were taken in 81, so this little kid, if she's still alive, is actually an adult now. Religion is so important to the people. Here's a typical First Communion class and a Mass that I had kind of celebrated at. One day in a refugee camp, I was working, celebrating the Mass, and this woman, in the homily, Father Cortina, had said, don't you think that since you people have gone through so many terrible things, God would understand if you tried to get some revenge on these people? And just as I took this picture, this woman was saying, oh, no padre, no puede ser. And he said, well, why not? I said, well, because we're Christians. So that was her explanation for why she really felt that vengeance would not be appropriate, even despite the fact that kids were at least living under these conditions. Again, you can see the pain in the face of these women. Here they were receiving communion at the refugee camp. You can almost imagine a whole history in this man with the guitar and then the woman on the left behind him. This is to prove I was actually there. I was giving out communion in San Jose de la Montaña in 1981. On the left is Sister Madeline Dorsey, actually Sister Maddie, as she's known, about 2-3 years ago, received an honorary doctorate from Lemoyne College. She's in her late 80s now and worked for many, many decades as a nurse and as a teacher in El Salvador. She and a couple of other Marianos ran this parish, and I was just the mass priest for them. This again is the refugee camp. You see the woman in the middle there, Maria. A few days after I took this picture, she was captured by the security forces, and only because she had friends in the Spanish embassy was she released and not disappeared. This is myself, and this is in 1981, standing next to the jeep in which Father Rutilio Grande and two other people were murdered in 1977. This is the altar in the Aldea Providence Hospital where Archbishop Romero was saying Mass when he was shot. Roberto Dalvison, head of the death squads and later a candidate for president, sent a sharpshooter in who from the back of the church just about here had one bullet right through Romero's heart, and he was dead. This was his original tomb, which was upstairs. The Archbishop later on decided that it was a distraction, and so they put him downstairs in the crypt, but they've since tidied it up, and it's quite nice. But many, many people who felt that they had received miracles through his intercession began to put these plaques on his tomb when it was upstairs. This is Archbishop Chavez y Gonzalez. He became the Archbishop of San Salvador in 1938, and therefore he was at the Vatican Council. And in a quiet way, he laid the groundwork for many changes of making the Church more responsive. He finally retired in 1977, and that's when Archbishop Romero came in. And Romero at the time was the candidate of the landowners and of the military, but of course then he became transformed and was quite different. He was then succeeded by Archbishop Arturo Rivera Damas, who was here saying Mass up in the town of Chalatenango only a couple of months after the nuns had been murdered there in December of 1980, and I accompanied him on this trip. Later on, when I was a member of the Board of Trustees of Loyola in New Orleans, I was able to recommend Archbishop Rivera for an honorary degree, which he received. He died at the age of 73 then, great consummation of all. This is the auxiliary bishop, Rosa Chavez, who's still the auxiliary bishop. When he first came in, he was into French cuffs and Episcopal dignities and all that sort of thing, and he quickly changed and became a spokesperson for the poor. Here he is outside of the cathedral in one of his famous press conferences. This is the 10th anniversary of the murder of Archbishop Romero, the Mass there. You can see the Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles here at this Mass in the cathedral. And in this group here, you see Father John Sobrino in the middle, who is a liberation theologian who recently ran into some problems with the Vatican. And right behind him, with his hands up to his face and eyeglasses, is actually the founder of liberation theology, Father Gutierrez. And they were celebrating at the Mass for Archbishop Romero's anniversary. When we went into Chalatenango, into the convent with Archbishop Romero, we were picking up some of the documents and things from the rooms of the American churchwomen who had been murdered the previous December, and a lot of their stuff was still strewn there where the soldiers had raided the place. And they're buried, the Marinol sisters, Sister Edith Ford and Maura Clark, are buried here at the end of a cemetery in Chalatenango. Marinol has the custom that when their missionaries die in another country, they bury them right there. Here you can see the bodies have been recently exhumed and had only been put back recently, and they hadn't even put the cement back on the outside. Marinol is spelled wrong on the tomb. On the way back from that particular trip, we ran into problems with the tire. Here's the Archbishop checking it out before the tire got changed. This is the constant presence of military all over the place, and which had a terrifying effect on people because they acted so arbitrarily. In the middle of the night, they'd come in, and that was the end of you. And yet, great hope. These are little kids in another refugee camp where I did the Holy Week liturgy, and they were. This was Good Friday, and they were having a procession, and these terrific kids expressing their faith and their confidence in their country. This was at the Easter Vigil, which I celebrated, and again you see the tremendous angst on the face of these people. This is Archbishop Bishop Casaldallia from Brazil, who actually was there at the liturgy when John Sobrino came back after the assassination, and John Sobrino was on the left there, sort of split in the middle by a cross, and over on the right is the Jesuit provincial who is now the president of the university. But this was an important event where Father Sobrino was able to come back. You see some of the artwork in the background by Fernando Yort. This is the chapel where the Jesuits are buried. This is Father Ignacio Ellacuría, who was the president of the university and was murdered. He was an outspoken person on human rights, and was one of the first people to call for a negotiated settlement of the war. I first met him in 1982, because when I went there in 81, he was in exile. I introduced him at a speech in Georgetown and knew him very, very well, a very sophisticated, incredibly intelligent, shy individual. This is Father John Cortina, who died about 6 months ago. He did a tremendous amount of work up in Chalatenango, where the nuns had worked before they were murdered, and was an engineer and doing all sorts of marvelous things. He's buried in the same place as the martyrs. This is John Sobrino, who is 68 now and has a lot of health problems with diabetes, but he's been one of the most important spokesmen for liberation theology, especially in the area of Christology. This is John Sobrino saying Mass at the place where the Jesuits were murdered, and this was the very day that he had returned from outside. It was his first trip back after the assassination. This is myself actually saying Mass in one of these areas, and it's really kind of funny because you see the kids walking around and all that, and the parents thought it was just fine. I never quite adjusted to not having the rapt attention of the community, but one adjusts. Elections are an interesting thing in El Salvador. If you really have only candidates from the center-right and the right, there isn't that much of a choice. And this was, which says vote for El Salvador, now or never. And the voting was for the Arena Party, which of course was red, white, and blue. And it was the party of the right wing, founded by Roberto D'Alvison, who was the founder of the death squads. The Christian Democrats were there. It says vote for the winner, vote green. This was the symbol for the Christian Democratic Party, but then you see the military patrolling through the streets on the left-hand side. The Christian Democrats were pretty much middle of the road to the right, and a number of people would vote for them simply because there was no alternative. And a lot of times they would have signs up for the military, you know, with God and with the people, we will achieve peace. And you could see somebody threw some red paint on the sign and didn't quite take the same view of the military's role in achieving peace. But elections are interesting too. They really do. If you don't have conditions for an election and candidates from a wide spectrum cannot attend the elections as candidates or as participants, then you have people choosing a very limited number. And the United States was always very much in favor of elections, whereas the Jesuit University had a polling center which actually used to give the true opinion of people on these things. And you have poor people like this man here, and he's one of the poll watchers for the Arena Party. There is no connection between his actual life situation and the right-wing party headed by death squads who are in the party. Here, this is a very typical picture here. You have one of the poll watchers for Arena, the death squad party on the left, in close communication with the military all during the election, and you can just imagine what effect that had on conditions. This is one of the polling places there. On the right is Father Nacho Martin Baró. At the time, he was the academic vice president at the UCA, at the Universidad Centroamericana. And I took this picture, but later on, after he was assassinated, I took his position as vice president of the university. This was the Jesuit high school, which is interesting, too. Archbishop Romero at one point called it the Colegio Rojo, the red high school. And a number of leaders from the civilian opposition to the government were meeting here. In fact, in this very office, which I had been using at one particular point. And the military surrounded the high school, captured these people, and their tortured dead bodies were found the next day, just 1 week before the American church women were killed. This was one of the teachers at the university, and he was being he was being protected at the Jesuit community when we were living there in 81. Then the next day, one of his former students, who was from the well-to-do people, actually took him into Guatemala, into exile. And this is when they were actually leaving for the border. This is Father Segundo Montes. He was also one of the Jesuits who was murdered. He was my chauffeur in some of the earlier pictures. Montes was the rector of the Jesuit community, but he also was the head of the political science and sociology department. He was a pastor, and he ran the Human Rights Institute also. This was Selena, one of the the daughter of the woman who was murdered along with the Jesuit priest. This is Father Nacho Martin Baró baptizing a little child. Now, this is in July of 81 again. This picture was used in the New York Times, actually, in a big article about the Jesuits sometime later. That little kid who's there now is probably about 26 or 27 years old. And here's Nacho doing another baptism. This is what we kind of celebrated in the refugee camp. The main celebrant is Father Fernando Amaya, who is the pastoral vicar. Then next to him in the red shirt is Father Nacho Martin Baró, one of the martyrs, and then myself. Here's some of the martyrs taking a bit of recreation. On the left is Nacho, who was later murdered. The next one over is John Cortina, who died about 6 months ago. The one in the blue shirt is Father Estrada, Paco Estrada, who became the president of the UCA after the assassination of Father Ayacuria when I was vice president. And on the right is Segundo Montes, who was one of the martyrs. So you have two of the martyrs there, and one is a survivor and one who has died since. The Universidad Centroamericana is a university for social change, and it was set up in the 60s more as protection against what they felt were the evils of communism. And then a few years later it began to speak out on social issues. They run programs in engineering, in architecture, in the humanities, in education, a whole bevy of subjects. And in a very, very simple place, it looks very, very peaceful. In some ways it was like an oasis in the middle of chaos. That was my office up there on the second floor, in a beautiful setting. But the Jesuits were murdered because they spoke out. They did research on key social problems, and they wrote about these things, and were trying to suggest solutions to these particular problems, and they just became too much of a threat for the military, who then assassinated them. This is one of the gardens at the university. Actually, I was interviewed by Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes on this, but they decided that Father John Sobrino and I might have some problems with surviving, and so they used some other stuff, and so we ended up on the cutting floor and never made it to 60 Minutes. This is the library, one of the best in Central America. And this is where the Human Rights Center was and the Polling Center. Again, these two institutes did a tremendous amount of solid research, which was then turned into policy recommendations. This is from my office, actually, when I was vice president. Looking out the window, you can see the military helicopters flying by. This was a fairly common scene. This is the pastoral center, the Romero Pastoral Center, and the Jesuit residence is at the far end of it at the time. The night of the assassination, several of the soldiers came in on this side and were let in by Father Ayacuria and Father Montes. That's the gate that they came in. They set up a machine gun here to shoot at the building to give the impression that there had been an exchange of fire between the rebels and the military, but the military were the only ones there. Meanwhile, Don Obdulio and his wife were living here with their two children, and their son had gone out to the countryside with some relatives. Don Obdulio stayed in the house, but his wife and his daughter stayed for the night because they thought they'd be more protected in the guest room, the place for receiving visitors in the Jesuit residence, and that's why they were killed. The other soldiers came in here, and on the left-hand side, just inside the gate, is where they encountered the two women. And then they went up to the end where you can see the steps leading into a little garden, and that's this is the garden here. Five of the Jesuits were murdered here. They lay them out on the field, and then there was a sixth one who was asleep, Father Lobo López, who actually didn't hear them until the shooting, and that he came out, and then they followed him back into his room and killed him inside. But this is Nacho Martin Baró, who you saw in the voting booth picture, and also in the baptism. He was on this side. In the far right is Father Ayacuria, the president, and on the left is Armando López, the three of them who were murdered that day. And there's so many memorials for them. These are in Santa Clara, Segundo Montes and Nacho Martin Baró. This is where they're buried, actually, in that same chapel where you saw it before. Standing in front of them is Michael Cherney, who later was Father General's assistant on social and pastoral ministries, and was a graduate student with me at the University of Chicago. Michael is now doing work on AIDS in Africa. And so the six Jesuit martyrs are buried right there. Now, this is Don Rabilio on the left. He has since died. He is the widower of the woman who was killed and the father of the young woman who was killed. Here he's talking to Father Steve Prevett, who is now the president of the University of San Francisco and with my successor as academic vice president at Santa Clara. Don Rabilio has this garden where he has roses for the six Jesuits and red ones, and he has two yellow ones for his wife and for his daughter. These are some scenes, again, of just remembering that these are kids who were suffering the ravages of war, lost many of their parents. People living to work all day long in order to survive. The dependence of that little girl on the person who's extending her hand to her is, so again, so symbolic of so many people trying to help each other. And yet there's great optimism too. This is a Santa Tecla, the garden. And El Salvador is a beautiful country. They've just gone through some terrible things.
Okay, can we have the lights back on? I thought it was important for you to see the people. First, they are the reasons why Jesuit universities make a difference. And as you can see, these questions are not abstract questions to amuse us academics. Peter Hans Kovenbach, the Superior General of the Jesuits at Santa Clara at the anniversary, called us to a faith-filled concern for justice. He asked that faith justice, the thrust of the Jesuit order and its colleagues, not be just one more apostolate, but an integrating factor in everything that we accomplished. And the great Pedro Rupe, Father Kovenbach's predecessor, coined the famous phrase, men and women for others. It almost seems a cliche now, but nonetheless it's real and vibrant for our times. Father Kovenbach reminded us at Santa Clara that the 32nd General Congregation of the Order, held in 1975, avoided traditional words like charity, mercy, and love. Neither philanthropy nor even development would do. The congregation instead used the word the promotion of justice, with its connotation of a well-planned strategy to make the world just. Kovenbach insisted, quote, that only a substantive justice can bring about the kinds of structural and attitudinal changes that are needed to uproot these sinful, oppressive injustices that really are a scandal against humanity and God. In other words, we need an action-oriented commitment to the poor, rooted in solid research, and a courageous personal option, and I would add an institutional option too. Now, Pope Benedict XVI's first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, which contains so much that is positive, nevertheless seems to push the pendulum back in the opposite direction by limiting the task of the Church of creating a more just society to only actions by political entities and actors. He focuses attention instead on charity, more in the sense of works of charity. Now, Father Tom Massaro, a professor at the Weston School of Theology, suggested in a recent article in America that this emphasis on charity could weaken the importance of the creation of a just society and the role of the Church in reflecting on justice conditions. Father Kovenbach summed up the thrust of his argument by asking how our colleges and universities will proceed, what will our faculty and staff members do, and who will our students become? As educators, we do not seek to control who our students become or what they will think or do. Our role is to provide a context, to make available the resources they need to mature, to challenge them as they find their own ways, and periodically to help them reflect on what they have accomplished. We help our students gain the skills and attitudes that will lead them to make a profound personal commitment and to live in solidarity with all persons, especially those in need, like the people that you saw in the slides. Ignacio Ellacuría, whom you also saw in the slides, used to insist that the goal of learning at our colleges and universities was not the accumulation of information, but to understand what he called la realidad, to understand reality, and not just our own little reality where molehills become mountains at the slightest provocation. Reality for AU Korea and the Jesuit University was the widespread poverty and injustice that you saw in the slides. He summoned the university community to prepare itself to exercise solidarity, not just by giving from our superabundance, but through real solidarity. In his America article that I mentioned before, Father Massaro quotes Pope John Paul II, who defines solidarity this way: solidarity is not a vague feeling of compassion or shallow distress at the misfortune of many people, both near and far. On the contrary, it is a firm and persevering determination to commit oneself to the common good. That is to say, the good of all and each individual, because we are really responsible for all. Now, Father Massaro looks more closely at poverty, not as an abstraction, but as living men, women, and children like those in the slides. He describes two approaches to the poor. One is the culture of poverty advocates, who he says tend to blame the victims, as opposed to those who focus on the what of poverty, namely the structures that cause poverty by blocking opportunities for social advancement: racial and gender discrimination, geographic segregation of low-income families, segmented labor markets, inadequate educational systems, and a host of other social injustices that render the disadvantaged even more distant from the mainstream of society. Now, this is not the time to enter into a discussion of the root causes of poverty, though such studies should be going on in our classrooms. But using Father Ayo Correa's phrase to study reality, however, we should recall that at the end of last year, there were almost 40 million poor persons in the United States, many of them children, not to mention the many millions who live in unspeakable squalor in so many other parts of the world. Now, when his encyclical on the Catholic University, Ex Cordia Ecclesiae, Pope John Paul II urged Catholic colleges and universities to examine what he called serious contemporary problems in areas such as the dignity of human life, the promotion of justice for all, the quality of personal and family life, the protection of nature, the search for peace and political stability, a more just sharing in the world's resources, and a new economic and political order that will better serve the human community. University research, he says, will seek to discover the roots and the causes of serious problems of our time, paying special attention to their ethical and religious dimensions. He even goes on to say in that same section, quote, "If need be, a Catholic university must have the courage to speak uncomfortable truths which do not please public opinion, but which are necessary to safeguard the authentic good of society." Now, spelling out this reality even further, Mary Ann Cusimano Love, a professor at the Catholic University in Washington, looks at some of the negative effects of globalization, factors that doom many millions to a cycle of poverty. Now, she does not bash globalization, as too many critics do, but she takes a more realistic view of its immediate effects on the poor than does Tom Friedman in his recent book, The World is Flat. She points out that the world's poorest countries have experienced no income growth, and instead, income declines. And the advances in life expectancy and education made after decolonization have been reversed in the last decade in Africa due to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. These developing countries find their agricultural products cut out of the global markets due to protectionist agricultural policies in the U.S. and other countries. And that's what a point that I mentioned when you saw the dependence upon agriculture. She also points out that even with global movement toward debt reduction and debt forgiveness, poor countries still pay more money in debt repayments to banks in rich countries than rich countries pay to poor countries in aid, trade, and investment combined. She doesn't blame all these problems on the developed nations. There is plenty of blame to grow around, and plenty of homegrown causes of poverty, such as corruption, conflict, poor governance, democracy deficits, poor human rights, etc. Now, Dean Blackley, who went to the UCO with me in San Salvador after the assassination, he spoke here and gave this lecture in 99. He challenges his students to discover the truth of reality. Quote, discovering truth requires reason integrally considered. That is, rooted in experience and practice and nourished by contemplation, affectivity, and imagination. Only such an enriched reason that engages the whole person, intellect, will, and emotions, only that produces wisdom. He urges us to help our students to, quote, discover their vocation in life, above all, their vocation to love and serve. Now, all these citations suggest the nature of our role in helping our students immerse themselves in reality by studying the historical roots of problems, exploring solutions, engaging in research and reflecting on their experience, and eventually committing themselves to make a difference in the formation of a more just society. This is the central thrust of our vocation and mission in a Jesuit college or university for justice. But each college and university must respond with imagination and competence in its own situation, and not just replicate a model from other contexts. The Jesuit University of El Salvador that you saw in the slides started out as a bulwark for well-to-do Salvadorans to save their children from the national university, which they considered to be Marxist and communist. But a young Jesuit provincial, provincial superior in the 1960s, Father Luis Acherandia, who's still going strong in his late 80s, he had the foresight to send some brilliant young Central American Jesuits for doctoral studies in Europe and the United States. And when these men returned to San Salvador, they taught at the UCA, and they took over a journal called Estudios Centroamericanos. It was a very pious journal that had articles in there for the spiritual enrichment of the people who happened to be reading it. But they took the thing over, and they made it the official journal of the new university. And the Jesuits gathered around them lay colleagues who were eminently qualified in their fields and believers in the new mission of the UCA, and also in contact with the terrible reality of Central America. They researched key issues such as the 1969 war between Honduras and El Salvador, the so-called soccer war. They looked at land reform and the conditions affecting the teaching profession, the role of the military, and the violation of human rights. As a new edition came out of ECA, it would have a whole journal on each topic at tremendous depth. Now, this was serious, solid scholarship, and not the mere cobbling together of partisan political views, even though that's the way the opposition saw them. They built the research centers of human rights and opinion polling that you saw on the slides. And Father Ayucuría's editorials are the most important analyses of the complex social, political, economic, and ethical issues that racked Central America in the 1970s and the 1980s. They were read avidly all over the world, even in the United States Embassy in San Salvador. The UCA established academic programs, as you saw, in all the usual fields. And Father Nacho Martín Baró, talking about their research, used to say that in the United States, at Jesuit University, it's publish or perish, where in Central America, it's publish and perish. And as you can see, that happened to a number of them. They did not provoke opposition for its own sake. They let the data speak for themselves. They saw their research as valuable in itself in an academic sense, and at the same time geared toward the articulation of policy that might change society, what they called a national project. The result of their commitment was a new vision for El Salvador, but it also brought 17 bombs, constant threats, and ultimately their assassination 18 years ago. Now, moving over to Guatemala briefly, the oppressive military occupation of that country made the Jesuits and their lay colleagues at the Landiva more cautious than those at the UCA in El Salvador. In the 70s and the 80s, they focused their attention on the preparation of professionals, and they established a very important Instituto Lingüístico, which fostered a deep understanding of the Mayan culture. A good number of the most prominent Mayan leaders in Guatemala today received their degrees from the Landiva. And then in the 1990s, there was another large scholarship program which educated 1,000 Mayan leaders at the graduate level. In the 70s and in the 80s, the UCA and the Landivar seemed to be 180 degrees apart from each other. And in many important ways, they were, especially under the leadership of several conservative Jesuits and lay colleagues in Guatemala. In the late 90s, however, the Jesuit order decided to bring about a change toward a more just social vision at the Landivar, and an improved political situation made that change a lot safer. At the present time, the UCA and the Landivar have very similar missions for the preparation of dedicated, competent professionals who can serve as change agents. And the Landivar has expanded a lot of these programs into public health and conflict transformation. The one in Nicaragua, there isn't time to talk about it, but it was much more similar to the UCA in El Salvador than the Landivar, and all three of them are now pretty much working together. Now, in the early 2000, I switched from Central America to Central New York. Although my life was never threatened in Syracuse, I almost froze to death, and I experienced many similarities in my role as president of Lemoyne, which defined its mission as academic excellence, rooted in faith experience, and dedicated to fostering a more just society. Lemoyne developed new centers of special excellence in areas such as Catholic studies, including the nationally acclaimed Lemoyne Zogby polls on contemporary Catholic trends. Other centers focus on urban and regional applied research, peace and global studies, and the environment. Faculty members and administrators have launched programs for social entrepreneurship in close cooperation with nearby universities and other university partners. And faculty and alumni get very involved in the community in ways very similar to what you do here at Creighton. And now our Father General, as we said before, has asked me to help out in Africa. And we're proposing an institute which is going to do a lot of the work for planning in Africa, to engage in research on models for involvement in African higher education, and look at feasibility studies. Right now I'm doing a sabbatical so that I can learn a lot more about Africa than I know right now. But these academic programs will be developed either as Jesuit universities or as Catholic universities is not clear yet. Although Jesuits have held faculty positions in public universities and have helped found and have taught in African Catholic universities, there are no Jesuit universities in Africa at the present time. And the dramatic needs of the people of Africa and the availability of a rapidly growing number of African Jesuit vocations, however, suggests strongly that good things can happen. Newspaper headlines have focused on African post-independence crises, governance problems, corruption, and the AIDS epidemic. And no one can deny the importance of these issues. But as these reports distract readers from the many signs of hope in Africa, increasing economic development, rising political leadership of a different stripe, and many efforts to conquer the AIDS devastation, the Jesuits of Africa want to really help out with this. Let me just pull together of saying there were great similarities from my work in El Salvador. There was kind of helping the university survive. And the Landivar, it was really helped to turn it around. At Lemoyne, it was able to take the social vision and see how it might apply to the first world. And now we're looking at some of these things in Africa. So there's a great continuity in it. When I read the mission statement of Creighton, or if I read it of other universities, there's a great deal of similarity. And so when we look back at the tradition of the UCA Jesuits, they got killed for what they did. And I knew them, I talked to them on the phone 10 hours before they were assassinated. But they went about it in the most natural way you could possibly imagine. They didn't consider we're doing something terribly profound. Everybody should appreciate us and put us on holy cards. They were much more involved in what they were doing. They were men of prayer, and they had wonderful colleagues helping them. So that's sort of some of the stuff that we've been doing before. You saw the poor people who were really the ones that we hope to really help with our institutions. We hope to be doing something similar in Africa, and I know you're doing it here in Creighton. So thanks for listening, and now let's hear your questions.
Is this on? Yes. Oh, my God. Thank you very much, Father Byrne.
I will go up and down the aisles and pass on the microphone to anybody who would like to ask Father Byrne a question. Yes, sir, a student. Good start.
I was wondering where in Africa there have been considerations for building the Jesuit University.
Well, one of the fun things about the project is they're going to be looking at the continent as a whole and seeing what are the criteria, the mission, the objectives you want to accomplish, and then see which places might be ready for it. Right now it looks as if it could be in Nigeria, on the East Coast, in Kenya or in Tanzania. There are possibilities in the Congo where we have 6 high schools, or perhaps Nigeria or Ghana. There's a Catholic university just beginning now, St. Augustine's, in South Africa. And South Africa is the country that has the most resources. So they better look at what's the place that it's going to be more likely to have an impact, because you want to also have an education for the students, like the students here, but you also want to have centers for research and to be able to make an impact on the structural level so as to change these kinds of conditions. So you'll have to ask me that again in 5 years, and we'll see what has happened. It's their project. I'm just there to help them a little bit.
Who wants the mic? I feel like Bob Barker.
Sometimes I hear this criticism of the education that takes middle class kids into the communities of the poor and opens their eyes, so to speak. That are these programs using the poor to kind of educate the middle class? What really is in it for the poor? They're not attending Jesuit schools, maybe in Guatemala, but generally not in the United States. Could you comment?
Yeah, well, a couple of different things. When the students go out, it has a tremendous impact on them. And then I sort of bring them down to size a little bit by saying, if you go out into the community to serve when you're, say, a high school kid, not so much a college kid, but if you're a high school kid, the only thing I can hope is you don't do any positive harm to the community. Yeah, because they really don't have the tools to do it. But if they go into a community where there are other people working with the community and help them see the community and then reflect with them on their experience, then it's not like going to some kind of an exhibit where you look at people from the outside. But that's always the problem. But how do you get it started? How do you get them into the community so they can begin to see how people really live? And then what difference is it going to make later on in their lives? Now, when you have a university in the so-called third world, you're going to be dealing with a small, limited number of people who work their way through the pyramid to get to higher education. You could never have a university in the third world that mirrored the population with the same percentage of poor and middle class and well-to-do, because most of the ones who get that far are already in the middle class and the upper classes. So what do? You try to work with them in such a way that they will prepare themselves to make structural changes in the country. So it's not the direct effect they have on the poor when they go into these communities, but how their horizons get opened up and how they then begin to be trained in economics or in political science or in theology to be able to make a difference in their countries, that they'll really be change agents. So I think when you have these programs where we bring students into the so-called third world or even to the communities of poor communities here, we have to have very, very good people who can help them understand, look, you're going to be shocked at what you see. You don't realize how comfortable you are. Now, you don't want to put a guilt trip on them, but on the other hand, you want to say to them, you're going to go into the community and they have a lot to give you. Like, you remember that woman, the woman who made the comment when John Cortina said, don't you think God would understand if you had a little revenge to kind of get these people? Well, her look of indignation, no, padre, como puede ser? Yo soy cristiana, I'm a Christian. And there was such a tremendous faith. Any student who saw her at that particular time and seeing she's in a refugee camp, and this is her actual attitude, I mean, they would just be astonished. But I think what you bring up is very important. How do you guard against making them like objects in a museum or even worse, in a zoo? You know, we just kind of stare at people. And that's why I think the sensitivity of faculty members, and then incredibly important, is the reflection on the experience of being with these folks. And I think then it can have a marvelous effect that you couldn't have just by going out there and adding to your resume. Yes.
Father, it's been said that
after the assassination of the Jesuits, that the Jesuits in the United States and their friends had an impact on U.S. foreign policy directly. Is that true from your perspective? And why don't we do it again in other areas?
Oh yeah, I could go on for hours on that. It had a tremendous impact. You see, when they murdered Archbishop Romero, you saw the altar where he was murdered in 1980. There was a bit of a fuss for a while, and then it kind of settled down. Then later, in 1980, the same year, Romero was killed in March. They were killed in December, the nuns. Well, there was a big hullabaloo. They were American citizens, etc. And it kind of calmed down. But then, when they killed the Jesuits, they really miscalculated, because the international uproar was tremendous. The United States Congress taking an interest, especially with Congressman Joe Moakley. Joe headed a committee and went down there, and his assistant, Jim McGovern, who's now a congressman from Worcester, went down with him. And Joe was very, very funny. Joe said, Charlie, the only international thing I ever did was to go into Little Italy and get some pizza. You know, he had never done anything international before. And here he's being asked by Tom Foley to go in and investigate this. It had a tremendous effect. Now, this was during the, you know, Reagan and Bush years, and it was kind of hard to have any kind of an effect in some of this. When I was dealing with it later on, we do damage control, and that was about it. It got better under the Clintons. There was much more concern for human rights, but it was very, very, very difficult though, because the United States government sends these people on mission to these countries, and they're usually there about 3 years. And I met a lot of really wonderful people there, but they're guarded constantly. One of the ambassadors was not one of my favorite people. He was telling me one time that I go out into the villages and I talk to the people so that I can influence U.S. policy. I said, but Mr. Ambassador, do you go out with one or two people and walk around, you know, in old clothes? No, I can't, for protection and so forth. I said, that's true. You go out with four or five Cherokees full of goons with rifles, and you're going to say to the people, do you think the government is doing any damage here? What do you think they're going to say to you? So I think to some extent it was very hard to penetrate that impregnable wall of policy that was so idiotic. But I think once they began to see some of these things, they cut back on the military aid, and some changes happened. Now, with regard to the current situation, why the people are allowing so many terrible things to happen. I mean, a war that shouldn't have happened in the first place. We got into it on deceit. We're staying there because we basically don't know what to do. We got in and had no consideration of what we were going to do once we got there. And now it's a mess. Now, does that mean you just march out and say, hey, guys, we're sorry, we made a mistake coming in here? No, you can't do that. So, right now, what can we do? I think electing members of Congress who are really going to stand up on these things, come up with some creativity, to elect somebody for the White House is going to give a whole new vision. I have great confidence in that process. It had an effect in the past, but it was very difficult. I remember one time going to the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador, and they had this very bouncy guy who'd gone to a Jesuit college. I won't mention which one. It wasn't Creighton. And he was saying, you know, the great things we're doing down here, it's just terrific. And but he didn't know there were a number of us in the audience who knew a little bit about what was going on. And we said, well, what about this? And what about that? And after about 10 questions, the guy absolutely was beside himself. He said, you all sound like communists. I said, well, thank you for sharing, but that's not exactly what. But, you know, I had another problem with the ambassador. This was with Walker when he was ambassador. And he said to me, you Jesuits are not satisfied on the Jesuit case. We're doing all we can to figure out who did this. And you're not satisfied. And so I said to him, look, we're not satisfied because you're piling $1 million a day into this country for the war. Are you saying you have no leverage? And then he said, no, you guys, he kept attacking. I said, look, Mr. Ambassador, I just got one thing to say to you. If you do not know who killed the Jesuits at this point, you are incompetent. And if you do know, you're an accomplice. so you can take the choice. Well, he was not very happy with me. One of the reporters in Washington when I was there, this is the Miami Herald, Chris Marcus, he kept pushing me, saying, the ambassador feels you guys are unfair by insisting on change in policy and all this. So I said, no, I don't think so, and I gave my the stuff I just mentioned. And finally I said, so look, the ambassador thinks he put Father Ayacuria's picture up in his office and that is working on the Jesuit case. It just doesn't fly. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, it was the headline on the front page of the Miami Herald the next day, and the ambassador was not very happy with me. But I really felt so many times we were just throwing pebbles against the window, and that it didn't have much of an impact. But it had a tremendous impact in the universities and in the intellectual community, and eventually had more of an impact on policy. But it's a long, slow process. There's so much mindlessness, and it's not, it doesn't come from people who have lived the kinds of worlds that you saw on the screen tonight, or people being affected this way.
While I'm going toward the next question, let me just point out that if you wanted to go to El Salvador to see these things firsthand, we have a course that does that every summer. If you wanted to go to spend a whole semester in the Dominican Republic and see similar sorts of realities, we have that program for you too. See me afterwards.
Thank you very much, Father. The Jesuit education effort has been greatly cherished throughout the world. But coming to your talk, I try to link a Jesuit education with the social change that is in your title. I would like appreciate to hear more about the social change that through Jesuit education in Central America. Like Creighton, Father Bucko has done so much for the Indian reservation, and we see the education that our faculty brought to the Red Cross Indian School has really bear the fruit that having more students coming to Creighton and other universities. So what kind of educational effect in bringing the social changes in the Central America, Africa, America? And also what kind of social change you are expecting to bring by having a Jesuit university in Africa?
Yes.
Thank you.
I think it's on several different levels. One is to really give an opportunity to young students to get the kind of preparation that they're going to need in their process to make a difference. Because a lot of times we're outsiders coming from another place, and we can help them to prepare in ways that are appropriate, and I think have a great appreciation for what they need. But they're ultimately the ones that have to make a difference. But they have to do it with solid research and understand, as Ignacio Ayacuría talked about, la realidad. They have to be rooted in the reality of their countries, which means really solid data, which means kind of boring data gathering, which is not as much fun as giving fiery speeches somewhere. And so it has to be by that type of thing. But I think also, and this is a key element, it has to be rooted in something like Jesuit spirituality or some of the other spiritualities that we're very, very familiar with, etc. Because I think if people are not reflecting on what they're doing and why they're doing it, they're not going to take risks. They're not going to be really that confident. They really, in a sense, have to have that integrated thing of excellence that has deep roots in faith and is geared toward a more just society. And to be in a community of people who are going to be able to encourage them at moments when they're discouraged, and to be able to put pressure on some of the pressure points where it has to happen. So it's not easy. And also, as the faculty members know here, education is a work of faith. Because you don't really know which ones are going to be the ones that will really take off and make a difference. I know in my experience as a high school principal in Puerto Rico and at Regis High School in New York, you know, there's certain people you sort of say, oh, he's the future. That's the one who's really going to make a difference. And in some cases it was true. And other times it was somebody who was in the back who was kind of taking it all in and not saying very, very much and kind of came forward. So what do you do in our university? You create an atmosphere. You make resources available to the people to see what might stimulate them. Some things are going to be more effective with some people and other things with other people. But I think it has to be basically in solidarity, as John Paul II said, and that amazing thing, you know, because sometimes he said things that we had a lot of problems with in the third world, but this was really remarkable what he said there. To real solidarity has to be based on a faith conviction and on solid research and a willingness to commit oneself. So what is it going to look like in Africa? Well, right now we've got about 1,400 African Jesuits. The average age is in the 30s. I'm a veritable patriarch when I go over there, right? And yet I've been a member of the New York province, and the average age of the province kept going up, and I thought I'd never reach it. But I finally did. So what's going to happen there? And I even went a bit beyond it so far. But for example, there were a number. I was in Nairobi a year ago in the summer, helping them with the first meeting of this commission. One of the people there was a young Jesuit who was doing a doctorate in history at Oxford, in African history. Another one is just finishing a doctorate in the philosophy of science at the London School of Economics. So what a Jesuit university tries to do is create an atmosphere and resources by which good people are probably going to end up doing really good things if we keep encouraging them.
Another question here.
With the ethnic genocides and radical governments that control much of Africa right now, what do you think is the likelihood that the Jesuits trying to start a university and create social change in Africa will face the same type of violence that the martyrs in El Salvador face?
It's quite possible. There were a number of Jesuits who were murdered in Rwanda in that terrible genocide recently. Now, there are some positive signs. As you know, for many, many years, the European countries simply used these particular places to get out gold, diamonds, oil, whatever they happen to have, and only educated a minimum number of people to run the civil service in those particular countries. And finally, with the overwhelming thing of independence, basically in the 60s, you know, you had very few really well-prepared people. And there was an awful vacuum created in many of these countries, which was filled by some of these dreadful military types. And there's kind of a residue of some of them left right now, but there are hopes for change. The number of students who have gone to universities, I don't have the exact numbers, in recent times are enormous. In fact, that's a serious problem with the national universities in Africa. They're packed to the gills. Residence halls that were supposed to have rooms for two people have six. Classrooms, they're falling out the windows practically. So there's a whole new generation of people being educated, and we hope that that will be a critical mass that will make a difference. But I think, as with the Jesuits in El Salvador, they took no silly chances. I remember being with Montes, who's the one who's in that picture there and was driving me around in the beginning. One time I was coming back from celebrating a mass with him in this poor parish. I noticed he went down this street and that street, and I was getting to know the geography, and I said, why are you doing that? Why? He said, no, they usually have retenes, you know, the military stopping you there. So you just took other streets and you did it. So sometimes you have to stand up to them. I'll just tell you one little story. When I was vice president, I used to go over to that parish that you saw there that the Marinol sisters ran. And they said, I was just the mass priest. I went and said mass. They were the ones who were really running the show because they were so good. And I was going over and I was in my Jeep and I pulled up next to El Salvador's Pentagon, which is right on the right-hand side there. And that's where the soldiers went that night to kill the Jesuits. So I'm waiting for this, there's a blinking light that he had to stop, but I saw some crazy guy zooming along, and I waited until he went by before I drove right. Just as I was about to turn right, whammo, I'm hit from behind. I hear broken glass, and oh, this is what I need. I go back and see that this guy has rammed his headlight into the hook on the back of my Jeep. And he gets out and he starts screaming at me, and look what you've done. Usted tiene que pagar. You have to pay for this. And I just looked at it, and I had no damage at all. And he had slammed into me. And I said, well, here in El Salvador, you have a wonderful expression. El que pega, paga. Well, the one who hits pays, right? Usted pega, usted paga. It's easy, you know. And he says to me, I'm an assessor, an advisor to the Minister of Defense. And you will regret this attitude. I just looked at him and I said, and I'm a Jesuit priest and vice president of the UCA. The guy just turned white at that particular point. And I said, look, there was a time when we had trouble with people like you, but that time is over. Oh, you are insulting me. I said, thank you for sharing. And I got into the Jeep and I drove off. Now, I drove kind of quickly but 6 months later, I happened to be in Congressman Mulkey's office in Washington. I was there because we were trying to get rid of the UCA had a big debt from the Inter-American Development Bank of about $10 million, where they built all those buildings. Now, the trouble is that when the loan was done, the colon and the dollar were the same. And by the time we had to be paying back, it was a 7-to-1. So in terms of the local currency, the debt had increased 7 times. So we were doing some stuff with the Congress that since they supplied the bullets that killed the Jesuits, they could supply the dollars to take care of the debt. And so I was doing that stuff with Cristiani, the president of El Salvador, was there to try to get the military aid reinstated, see. So I went to Mokley's office and he said, Charlie, come on in here. I want you to meet President Cristiani. I said, oh God, this is all I need. So I walk into this room. There's Cristiani, his public relations person, and all these other characters. If looks could have killed, I would have been in McLaughlin's funeral home in Jersey City. It would have been all over, all right? So I go up, and one of the persons I'm introduced to is the Minister of Defense, now General Ponce. Now, at the time I was talking to him in Congressman Mokley's office, we knew that he was the one in charge of the cover-up. We found out later he was the one who gave the order to kill the Jesuits. Now here he is meeting me, Nacho's successor, and it's in the United States Congress, in the office of one of the most powerful members of the Congress. And so anyhow, this incident that I talked about before, that happened 6 months later. So I sent General Ponce a letter, Estimado General Ponce. I met this guy and he crashed into my car. I gave him the license plate. I gave him all the details and I said, I'm sure you would not want one of your asesores treating people this way. I got a letter back from General Ponce, Estimado Padre Bern. I don't know how this could possibly have happened and I will do an exhaustive investigation and all that sort of thing. Now, I kind of had him. I knew that this guy wasn't going to shoot me right then and there. At least it was highly unlikely. It was very, very clear that I was a gringo, and you get into trouble shooting gringos in some of these countries. But notice, I stood up to the guy, and others did, so we didn't just sort of say, oh, please. One night we got a threat at the university, and it said, tell the Jesuit president and the Jesuit vice president not to come tomorrow because they might not make it home in the evening. I stayed until 10 o'clock with the lights burning. And that was typical. I mean, I wasn't being heroic or anything. We had to, at one time, it was kind of a roundabout way of answering your question. There are times when you got to stand up and say, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. But you don't take silly chances and you don't go insulting them. Now, there was one American Jesuit who was involved in one of these protests at a particular time. And he started insulting the soldiers. And he had several young Central American Jesuit seminarians with him when he did it. I almost killed him when I heard about this. Because that's the sort of thing, you know, I said, you know, it's a great way to get on a holy picture, but this is not what we're here for. So in Africa, too, I think it's going to have to be of looking at the situation. You take chances. You live in a situation that has a certain amount of danger in it. You don't look forward to that. I wouldn't be particularly happy about being on a holy picture or anything. But you do the work that you have to. You do it as scholars. You do it as priests. You do it as lay colleagues. You do it as university people. Aparia had another expression where he said, we are not a political party, we are not a labor union, we are not a parish center. These all have very important roles. We are a university. And he said that everything that we did had to be done universitariamente. It had to be done as a university. And I think that's what will happen in Africa, that you'll be in some situations where there are going to be times you just got to speak out, or you have to write an analysis of what you think is going on. And there are certain military dictators who get very nervous about that. Anybody?
Right. Let's make this the last question.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, I'll be hanging out, and you can ask some more things up here if you want.
Father, you talked about Segundo Montes, who is one of my personal heroes and a person whose life I studied quite a bit several years ago. I wish more people would have read your book. The beginning part of your book in particular puts forth a radical model of the university that I don't think any Jesuit university in the United States lives up to. But my point is, Segundo Montes was a geologist. He was a person that was not trained in the social sciences, and he was a colleague of Luis Rodriguez, who's been here for many years, and I've talked to him about him. But he went back to Spain, went back and got his degree, and became a social scientist.
That's right.
Who did opinion research, who worked with migrants, who helped people in Honduras, and who was part of that estudio, which was this marvelous critique of the society using social sciences.
That's right.
Now, we all know that we have plenty of radicals in theology, philosophy, and the humanities. We got plenty of them. But in the social sciences, and not one single Jesuit university, nor as a colloquium with all the AJCU, I've never seen that kind of solid social science but based on radical justice. I don't know why that model has never been picked up and never been. You've been a university president. How do you encourage that? How do you make that a part of the faculty mission above and beyond just being solidarity with the poor and the students who see
them? Sure. Well, I want to say a couple words about Sigrid and Wuthers that complements what you were saying. But let me take the second part of your question first. One of the things that I saw at Le Moyne was there had to be these centers of special excellence. And we had to pick areas from the mission statement and see, are we bringing faculty together in an interdisciplinary fashion to look at some of these key questions? Now, they were doing it in business education to some extent, but they weren't doing it in the other areas. And when I got there, Baron Boyd from the Political Science Department was doing a grant for, he was in the beginning stages, for a Center on Peace and Global Studies. And now we're involving faculty members from the local schools and everything, going to different countries, seeing what's going on, bringing in lectures and conferences all over. So it was an area that was incredibly important for the mission. The same with the Catholic Studies Center. John Zagwe, the great pollster, is a Le Moyne alum. He's on the board and a dear friend. And he came to me one day and said, Charlie, Le Moyne ought to be the place that keeps track of what Catholics think about key issues. And so we started this center, and within a short time, we were doing national polls, which were being quoted all over the place. In fact, one of them, just a little side story, one of the polls was done to see what did the soldiers and the men and women on the ground think about U.S. policy. And it was a very elaborately done sort of thing with really good scientific background. And it came out that about 75% of the soldiers thought they were there in revenge against Saddam Hussein for what he did with the World Trade Center. You know, as you know, there was no connection. And there were a couple of other terrible things that these poor folks were over there sacrificing their lives without really understanding what these creeps in Washington were doing. Well, Doonesbury picked it up. And for 7 days, we were in the column, and it's Lord Cheney, as he's being called now, you know, and the conquistador with his hat. They're having this dialogue about, well, we can't tell the soldiers that there was no connection with Saddam Hussein because it might ruin the whole thing. But it went 8 days in Doonesbury, and it was the Le Moyne poll. So again, it's taking an area which is peace and global studies and Catholic studies. We did it with urban and regional studies. The Maxwell School at Syracuse University looks at some of these questions in a global kind of way. We were taking it in central New York and working with the Maxwell Center. Now that involved sociology, political science, involved the theology people, and now the business administration people. And then this a big grant we just got from the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City on social entrepreneurship with Syracuse University for $3 million. And then finally we got somebody in the area of environment who is a real expert on this. So it was a question of bringing faculty together and seeing key areas, run academic programs for them, but bring in speakers from outside, give the students opportunities to go outside. And I think, so it's a structural type of thing, the long range effect. You mentioned Segundo Montes. Remember, he's the one in the picture looking very serious up in a pulpit. The students used to call him Zeus. He had sort of reddish hair, and he was very tall, and he spoke in these stentorian tones, and he was just a wonderful, wonderful character. He was the rector of the Jesuit community, but he was in science before, in physics and everything, so he was the one that would put the electricity back together when it wouldn't go off. They were very, very real people. But the key thing in the Jesuit University, and that was something we didn't exactly try to replicate it at Le Moyne or in other places, but you have similar research institutes in places here where colleagues get together to look at interdisciplinary questions. So I think there are a lot of places where this is going on. It'll be too short. I know Steve Prevetz, is doing a lot of this at University of San Francisco. So there is a lot more of it going on. Now, should it be more explicit? Yes, probably. Would we like to have more of an impact? Yes. But it's a real struggle. I mean, you take right now, so much of our political dialogue is sound bites. The candidates spend an enormous amount of money just getting money so they can get their message out there. And then they play, you know, games with each other in some of these so-called debates. So it's very, very discouraging. It's very discouraging. But I think our universities are moving more and more on that. And I think the work that's been going on here that Ray's been doing and others have been doing with the Peace of Global Studies, the center here with Peace, I think there's a lot going on. So I'm pretty optimistic. Okay, well, it's time for you all to go home or to other things, but I'm so glad that you came. And I took the more theoretical approach and then the pictures and then some anecdotal stuff now. So I think it at least gives you the flavor of some of the stuff that's going on in Jesuit education. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, let me add my thanks to all of you for coming. For the diehards, Father Burns said he'd be willing to stick around a little bit. My last word is I got a call a little after 8 this morning when I first got to my office. It was Charlie. I've learned to call him Charlie. He says, "Where am I supposed to be?" And the answer to that is Charlie Burns is where the action is. Okay. So if you'd like to come up and have some more conversation, please do so. And see you October 2nd of next year.